in Commonwealth, Virginia. I hate when that happens.
It is still morning. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Ron Hearn with the Office of the Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Mrs. Porter, a defendant in the Circuit Court for the City of Fredericksburg. Your Honors, this matter comes before the Court and asks the question of whether or not a restitution order entered pursuant to 305.1 is actionable under 358.
Let me ask you this question, Counsel, so to get to the heart of the thing. Would you agree that the code provision as it has developed with regard to restitution has it made, as its original purpose, an obligation to be considered for suspended time that the defendant in a case such as this had to provide a restitution plan, that was the purpose of that statute?
That may have been part of the original thrust, Your Honor, but also I believe the restitution requirement was also to make whole the victim. I'm not contesting that either.
Well, and thank you for agreeing with that. Would you also agree, sir, that having a restitution plan in place pursuant to a sentencing order does not necessarily preclude any civil remedies that a victim might have in a case?
If the Court is inquiring, absolutely, I agree. In fact, the restitution plan code under 305.1 specifically makes reference to the fact that the Circuit Court may otherwise, at the motion of the victim, docket the judgment as a civil remedy. That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But that was not done in this case.
I'm taking you down the road, and I think you know where I'm taking you. since that civil remedy is available, you would agree then that a Circuit Court or a court that has jurisdiction over the matter has the ability to enforce its orders?
It would, Your Honor, but it would only have the civil remedies available to it if it were a civil judgment.
What about the judge's order in this case did not put the defendant on notice that, in effect, a civil order was being entered?
Your Honor, I believe the restitution plan itself says may, number one. The restitution plan within the joint appendix, if I may, Your Honor, forgive me. The last paragraph on joint appendix, page 44, this plan is filed with the court in accordance with 305.1. The defendant acknowledges the terms of this plan and understands the full amount of restitution, any interest may be docketed as a civil judgment in accord with 19.2305.2. Mm-hmm. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Yes, so where does that leave your client?
Your Honor, very simply, it leaves my client with the fact that 358 cannot apply, and here's the reasons as to why. It is indeed possible, and I agree that under the current law with Jackson in play, there's a question as to whether or not that 305.1 restitution obligation may indeed be actionable continuing past the probationary period. But I believe Jackson does not apply for one critical fact in this case. The Commonwealth's evidence in this matter was that specifically the restitution was ordered as part of the probationary consideration. That happens to be actually contained within, I believe, paragraph 5 of Joint Appendix page 22. So the proponent of the evidence brings into play the fact that the restitution is only for purposes of probation. The Commonwealth doesn't have the opportunity to then turn around and argue Jackson, and the reason why is a critical factual distinction. In Jackson, Your Honors, the same factual scenario occurred. An individual with a 1988 or 1998 conviction was ordered to pay restitution, and the question was, how are we to handle that? The Supreme Court of Virginia said clearly, looking at 305.1, that a restitution obligation can be either standalone, which is continually actionable, or it can be as a part of term and condition of probation. The Supreme Court also recognized one other thing. The two prongs are not mutually exclusive, and the facts in the trial court in Jackson suggest, rather, that it was not mutually exclusive because the trial court made a specific factual finding that the restitution obligation in the 1998 conviction order served as both freestanding obligation and also a term and condition of the probationary period. Here, the trial court never made that finding. In fact, the trial court turned the code on its head when it ruled, and if I may, Your Honors, I believe page 22 of the appendix in paragraph 20, any order is sufficient to bring the individual under the ambit of 358. That destroys any nullity between either a freestanding or a probationary requirement and renders all orders to be both mutual in that context, which is not what Jackson held at all. And also, the factual situation, Jackson does not apply for that reason also, because there is no such finding that the order served as both. No, Your Honors. The court said any order, and the order is constant in this case.
The court could have done this, but didn't.
Indeed, Your Honor. And it did not make that finding. Therefore, that evidence is not before the court. And part of the reason why that's critical, Your Honor, is I believe in Jackson, the Supreme Court recognized that appellate courts are to give deference to the trial court's interpretations of their own orders. There was no interpretation in this case. Simply, here's the evidence. I find that order to be applicable under 358. It's going to be applicable.
Why isn't that interpretation of the court's own order?
That is not an interpretation, Your Honor.
Why?
Because the Commonwealth, first and foremost, never asked for interpretation. Simply put it into play as the fact it is part of this probationary condition. That is the evidence within the record itself.
But didn't the court, in effect, interpret its own order by the contempt citation, the contempt determination?
Your Honor, if the court were to... I'm having an issue with evidence at this point in time. And I'm extremely sorry, Your Honor. I realized I began. I didn't ask for rebuttal. That's fine.
You want any time for rebuttal?
I'm so sorry, Your Honor. If the court gave me 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. If you answer this question, Rob, you get it.
The issue that I'm having, Your Honor, and the concern that I have is I know, for instance, if a trial court were to make... what's the word I'm looking for? Were to take judicial notice that has to be set specifically in the record and it must be set forth that they are taking judicial notice. Whether or not a court is interpreting an order, I am unsure with all due respect what the evidentiary burden is to set forth. And my concern is that there's nothing in the record, which is, by the way, by agreed stipulation as to what the written statements were, that the trial court made that determination. Both Commonwealth and the defense counsel agreed that the trial court held any order sufficed. In other words, without any actual language as to the fact that both arms of 305.1 apply. So that is why, yes, Your Honor.
Do you think Jackson is wrongly decided? I appreciate it's an unpublished opinion, but do you think the Jackson analysis is flawed, or do you think Jackson just doesn't apply in this case?
Jackson does not apply because the factual condition does not exist. Number one, and Jackson, I can't say is flawed, Your Honor, because this court is bound by Jackson. It would not be proper for me to argue it is flawed. But I do agree the Code Section 305B sets forth a general obligation without any discussion about as a part of any plan or set forth, and a subsequent section does discuss probation and suspension of sentence. So there are two separate vehicles that 305.1 has within the statute itself. But Your Honor, the action here isn't under 305, nor is it under 306, it's under 358. So the question begs itself, what are we doing under 358 and how do we get to 358? If the court looks at the code provisions of 358, the requirement is that an individual either default in payment or default in any installment payment. If we say that 305, which is what I'm arguing, does not apply and the restitution plan is under 305, it is inapplicable. But let us consider then also further, you only get to 358 through 354, because if you look at the code, the only provision that otherwise uses the phrase installment plan for payment of restitution actually is 354. In fact, the court, although I do not think Ori is binding on this court, because the issue in Ori was a little bit different, the court in Ori reached a similar type of position. The Commonwealth cites to Ori, and in Ori versus Commonwealth, the issue is whether or not the imposition of court costs was indeed an undue exercise on an individual's constitutional right to engage in a jury trial. And that court said, as a first matter of fact, we find it not to be an unconstitutional imposition. Subsequent to that was an unraised objection to the trial court that the individual was otherwise suffering under the guise of equal protection, and as is such, that was still an unconstitutional burden. The Court of Appeals, Judge Elder at that point, said that the issue had not been preserved at the trial court, but even on the merits, it would not suffice. 354 and 358 do not have a time limitation, but the context in which he spoke of it was the fact that you petition for payment of fines and costs under 354. If you can't pay, you can always at any time come back before the court and ask for a modification. If you ask for a modification, it doesn't happen, that's fine. If you default on the payment, as you have been ordered, then we're going to bring you under 358. If the court has a finding at that particular point, finds that you have not complied, you have complied due to not willful failure to pay, the court can modify again. the restitution, I'm sorry, the court costs plan. So therefore, you get through 354 to get to 358. And the language of the code itself, 358's installment plan, is only found in 354. Your Honor, that's as far as whether or not the 305.1 restitution order even complies for 358's requirements. There is also, of course, a statutory limitations argument. And in that aspect, Your Honor, the 19.2-8 puts forth the fact that the cause of action accrues, and that's the focus. And it's from 1 year point at which the cause of action accrues that the charge must be brought. If the focus of 305.8 is failure in payment or an installment payment, the cause of action would accrue from that point in time. The default occurs with that non-payment. It doesn't continue to accrue. It doesn't continue to exist. It's at that juncture. And unfortunately, the 358, the petition in this case was brought well outside the 1 year of the obligation as set forth by the restitution plan as of such as on time.
So you're extrapolating a statute of limitations from one statute and superimposing it on 358?
I am, Your Honor. And I understand it seems a little bit odd, but I'll explain to the court one thing. I understand that basically Ori seems to say there is no period in this particular case, but I would argue that there's actually no statute of limitations for any possession, like possession of drugs, be it larceny. Larceny is a continuing ongoing offense. The larceny code itself does not itself contain any statute of limitations. 19.2-8 applies, however, to all criminal type charges.
You're into your rebuttal time.
Yes,
sir. Like to save the rest?
Yes, if I could save the rest.
You have 35 seconds, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is asking the Court to affirm the trial court's ruling that the defendant was in violation of 19.2-358 for failing to pay restitution that was previously ordered by the Court. And I think it's important to start off by pointing out that the trial court's ruling in this case was not that just any order would suffice for 19.2-358. The specific ruling was a holding that a separate order pursuant to code 19.2-354 is not necessary under 19.2-358, and that any order obligating the defendant to pay restitution brings the defendant under the purview of 19.2-358.
So it's the Commonwealth's view essentially that there are two remedies that could have been available to the Commonwealth. One, pursuing the defendant for a violation of probation for failing to pay restitution under a typical probation violation hearing, or, if it chose to, pursuing the defendant under 358 under basically a contempt proceeding for failure to meet the obligation.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the Commonwealth's position.
Yeah.
And I think, Your Honor, when the court was asking, the defendant started asking about the 19.2-305.1, and that is specifically related to how the defendant, because she was going to receive a suspended sentence, she had to have the restitution plan that was attached. And so that goes to how Jackson, the Supreme Court in Jackson, said there can be dual purposes. One, the defendant had this restitution plan that needed to be included in order for her to receive her entirely suspended sentence, but the court's own order, sentencing order, ordered that she needed to pay restitution.
The Supreme Court's decision, or the Supreme Court disposition in Jackson was pursuant to order. What authority do you believe this court has with regard to the respect for the order of the Supreme Court? What is our responsibility as far as Jackson is concerned?
I think that the Supreme Court, this court does not, it's obviously not fully binding on this court because it was done, just an unpublished order. However, I think that it really gives a very informative, if not persuasive, value to how the Supreme Court looked at this and looked at the order and applied the very similar factual situation to this case. And the defendant points out that Jackson was different because of this trial court finding. However, the Supreme Court analyzed the original sentencing order and went through how, by analyzing that order, they found that the order had a dual purpose. And the order is very similar also to this case in that the costs was the first paragraph, and then was the restitution, and then was a paragraph about time served. And the Supreme Court said, you can't just piecemeal these paragraphs and rule, well, some of them apply, some of them don't, when you read them like that. The most persuasive argument is that the court was intending the restitution to be a separate obligation. And again, that is very, in that respect, Jackson and this case are very similar. Again, 19.2-358 does not limit itself to only 19.2-354. The plain language of the first part of the statute says that when an individual obligated to pay a fine, cost, forfeiture, restitution, or penalty defaults in that payment, then the Commonwealth may require to show cause them. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And, furthermore, turning towards to the second assignment of error, the statute of limitation, the Commonwealth would argue ORE is pretty on point for that. Yes, it deals with costs, but it's the same statute, and costs and restitution have been analyzed.
Yeah, there's no standalone, I know we're using that term a lot, standalone statute of limitations that applies to 19.2-358, and I think your opponent colleague has agreed with that, but he tries to extrapolate from 19.2-8. But in 19.2-8, we're talking about misdemeanors as opposed to a standalone contempt determination. So would you suggest that that statute would not apply?
I would, yes, Your Honor, I would suggest that statute would not apply. In this case, the court actually had two options, the Commonwealth show cause on a misdemeanor contempt and this contempt under 19.2-358, and the trial court's ruling was specifically on the 19.2-358. So yes, Your Honor, I would argue that that statute of limitations does not apply in this case. Again, the trial court correctly found that an order obligating the defendant to pay restitution brings her under the purview of 19.2-358. This defendant was well aware that she was ordered by the court to pay restitution. She had made payments and stopped making payments. She's still outstanding, was still $1,500. She does not never disagree that it was owed by her, and she should not now be permitted to avoid the consequences of failing to pay by a constrained view of 19.2-358. And if there are no further questions, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
There's just a couple points that the Commonwealth raised. The Commonwealth is suggesting, basically, in every case in which restitution, what it's asking this court to do is that in every case restitution is ordered, to turn around and subject an individual not just to the previously suspended sentence, which that's what's explicitly ordered, that's what the evidence in this case is, but to also subject them to further sanction for failure to pay, even when 305.1 is explicitly clear that non-payment will result in revocation, not in any other subsequent sanction.
But I think a reasonable interpretation of both of the statutes at play here, the one dealing with probation, restitution being an obligation of probation, the priority in that statute is to, number one, allow the defendant the opportunity for a suspended sentence. That's the main purpose, and coupling that with an obligation to pay restitution. Where if you look at 19.2-358, the primary objective there is, number one, to allow the court to enforce its orders, and number two, to allow a victim in a situation to recover restitution. So they're sort of coexistent purposes in the statute, and the court, based upon my understanding, has the obligation or the opportunity to enforce those coexistent obligations.
Your Honor, I may be prone to agree in a situation where...
You never want to agree with a judge, huh?
Your Honor, I may agree in a situation in which they were still under the guise of the suspended sentence. Mm-hmm. That wasn't what happened in this case.
So in other words, if the court had written the order differently, this may be a different case.
Absolutely,
because
Your Honor.
Because trial court judges speak through their written orders, there's specific language in the written order, and that confines the scope of that order.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. It's not just that, but it's also the fact that the evidence, the proponent of the evidence itself, suggested and only moved to have the restitution considered as a term and condition of the suspension of sentence. And therefore, I don't believe the court was free at that point to consider then anything else other than the fact it was just what it was, a term and condition of the suspension of sentence. For that reason, Your Honor, the restitution obligation would expire at the time that the sentencing order theoretically expired. which means that non-payment suit would have to be brought within 1 year time period. And the court did mention the fact that 19.2-8 only deals with misdemeanors. I'll draw the court's attention to 18.2-8, which says felony. Basically, there are crimes in Virginia both either felonies or misdemeanors. And the way the Commonwealth and the legislature defines misdemeanors happens to be, felonies, is anything either punishable by death or incarceration in a state correctional facility. Everything else are misdemeanors. If this is jailable by 60 days at a jail, that constitutes a misdemeanor, Your Honor. And as is such, it can still be importable for use under 19.2's application, can be used in 19.2-358. For all those reasons, Your Honor, and any other reasons, if there are no questions, I ask the court to reverse the trial court. Any order does not suffice, and this order definitively did not suffice in this case.
All right, thank you, Madam Smith. We'll come to counsel.